From the Sky News Centre at 5, Rupert Murdoch has been meeting Millie Doyler's family to apologise unreservedly for the News of the World hacking into her mobile phone. He's held talks with the murdered schoolgirl's parents and her sister. Earlier, Rebecca Brooks resigned as chief executive of News International. Police investigating three suspicious deaths at a hospital say they're determined to bring to justice whoever's responsible for tampering with medication. A woman in her 40s and two elderly men died following the deliberate contamination of saline solution at Stepping Hill Hospital in Stockport. Assistant Chief Constable Terry Sweeney says officers are patrolling the wards.
We are working very closely with the hospital to improve the security and protection of patients within the hospital, the staff themselves and their families, and it's our intention to ensure that there's no further harm caused by this incident.
The UK is sending four more Tornado jets to join the international operations in Libya. The aircraft will be deployed primarily in a reconnaissance role. The son of Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour has been jailed for 16 months for going on the rampage in London. Charlie Gilmour admitted violent disorder at a student fees protest last year. Now, you might not have heard of them before, but Colin and Chris Weir are now richer than Ringo Starr and Tom Jones. The couple from Ayrshire have faced the media after winning Europe's biggest ever lottery jackpot in the Euro Millions. And Colin is already drawing up his dream itinerary for his travels.
I would like to go to Australia and find out what is so spiritual about Ayers Rock. It's something that fascinates. Cambodia, maybe. Thailand. Visit the temple cities.
And Lee Westwood is in serious danger of missing the cut at the Open. He is four over after his two rounds, meaning he's projected to miss the rest of the tournament. Darren Clark holds a share of the clubhouse lead on four under. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping us review the news this week is Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith, and Public and Commercial Service Union's Regional Vice Chair, Roger Thomas, is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we get the Public and Commercial Services Union's view of the economic crisis and ask how are they preparing for the pensions crisis as well as promised hundreds of thousands of redundancies in the public sector. Plus, tomorrow is Bristol's Gay Pride Day, the culmination of a week-long programme of events with a parade from Queen's Square to Castle Park and an after-party at the Trinity Centre. We also hear from Pastor of the Spirit of Life Church in St Paul's, D.M. Moodley. He will question the role of Britain's gay community. And we have a final excerpt from Keith Allen's film Unlawful Killing about the death of Princess Diana. The film's being shown all around the world except here in Britain, where it's banned. And to round up, just before 7, Channel 4 News' political personality of 2007 died last month. Former merchant seaman and Parliament Square peace protester, Brian Hoare. I interviewed Brian at the Stop the War demonstration back in 2008, so we're going to have a little listen to that just before 7 o'clock. In the second hour, after 6 o'clock. Well, on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 degrees Celsius and fairly wet. This weekend, highs of 16, wetter on Saturday than Sunday, and also some gusty winds across the weekend. Next week, about the same temperature, 16 Celsius through the week, fairly wet and windy at times, possibly improving as the week progresses. Next weekend, the 23rd and 24th of July, highs of 16 again, sunny spells and some showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests. And joining us first is Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. Hi, Jenny, and Hello. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, Jenny, how long have you been a councillor in the city?
26 years.
And why did you decide to be a Labour Party member rather than one of the other parties?
I was born into the Labour Party. My father came out with a general strike. My mother went to Pankhurst sewing classes in the East End of London. However, I did go away from politics for a while, but the more I saw of the world that we live in, I was in the Middle East, poverty, the fact that there were so many wars, I came back to the conclusion my parents were right.
Well, you mentioned the Middle East there. Whereabouts were you in the Middle East, and what did you think of what was going on at the time?
I was in Cyprus, where I read the Talmud and the Quran in English, where I was fascinated at the number of churches that we had. We had people who were Turkish community, the Greek Cypriot community, Armenians who were fleeing out of Egypt where they were having a bad time. So for the first time in my life, I was learning about history, the geography of the world, and it expanding my thinking. And I saw poverty there, people with their legs cut off and all sorts of things, sitting in their own urine begging, that made me come back to the UK and want to work in charities.
So why is it, do you think, that so much of the conflict over certainly the last 40, 50 years seems to have revolved around the Middle East and the tensions between the Israeli state and the Palestinians?
Yes. Well, I think some of it, historically, was probably the English government's fault. I know that my parents were very, very concerned when Cyprus tried to get independence and supported the fact that they should be allowed independence. And it's the same. I met people who served in the British Army in Palestine, and they were very concerned about the way they suddenly went and left what was, in fact, the next war starting.
Now, getting back to Bristol politics now, many people think that actually it doesn't make a lot of difference which way you vote. There's not actually really much difference between these various parties. For a lot of people, look at the way that the council was run by Labour for many years. It's now being run by the Lib Dems, and they can't see the difference.
I'm going to say bunk. Absolute bunk. We're completely different. If you talk to the Tories, they say, at least we know where you're coming from, your Labour. And that's the most important thing, that we have a base that we stand for. We care about people that are less well off. We want people to have a decent education. We've always defended the National Health Service. And at the end of the day, you wouldn't have a national minimum wage without us. So we did change things, which this government are now trying to dismantle.
But aren't you really hanging on the coattails of the old Labour, where really what's happened is that Labour has been taken over by this new Labour faction, and the Milibands are part of that?
I don't think so. I think that the Labour Party is coming back to its grassroots. We're actually having workshops. We're looking at all our policies individually. We're discussing and looking at whether there are better ways of doing things, better aims that we go back to our grassroots with, and how we move on as a party, because it's absolutely essential. And as far as I'm concerned, New Labour's dead because it's outdated, and we've had to move on because the world we live in is a different world from when New Labour came in.
Well, it's all very well to say that, but surely when it comes to party conference time, you party activists and local councillors can say whatever you want. The leadership is just going to ignore it if it doesn't agree with it.
No, I disagree with that. I recently talked to John Healy in a room about the National Health Service, and it was a two-way thing. We were telling him about what was happening in our city and the concerns we had, and at the same time he was giving us information on this new health bill that was being proposed. So we were working as a team in that room, and some of us are now working very much as a team, so that it's a two-way thing.
Well, thanks very much. Now I'm also joined by Roger Thomas. Roger's the Regional Vice Chair of PCS, which is the Public and Commercial Services Union. Hi, Roger, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Now, Roger, first of all, what is PCS? What kind of members do you have, the union, and how many?
Right, well, PCS, or the Public and Commercial Services Union, is a union which organises workers in primarily the public sector, in what is generally known as the civil service. And to be more precise, because people probably seem to look at it now in terms of departments. We're talking about big departments like the Department of Work and Pensions and HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. Those are two of the biggest ones. I work for CLG, the Communities and Local Government. We cover, you know, a whole host of areas, land registry, coast guards, you know, a large areas, driving test instructors, a large number of areas of ordinary people's lives are affected by the work that's done by civil servants. And I'd like to say that most of those civil servants are very low paid. They're not on hundreds of thousands of pounds. The impression that's given in the press is that we're all bowler-hatted gents in Whitehall. That's not the case at all. We're local workers delivering much needed public services, making sure people get their pensions, their taxes correct, that people pay tax when they should do, and that other services that provided to ensure that our society is a civilized society and that people have the best opportunity to challenge any decisions which might be made that affects them.
So how big is the union? How many members have you got?
Well, we've got several hundred thousand members, as I say, across the public sector, but also a growing number in the private sector. That's areas that are covered by work that's government, that was previously done by civil servants in the public sector, but is now done by private companies.
Now, many people think the way that unions work is that you've got a big, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, but actually you've got a membership, a little bit, I was just describing with the Labour Party, that actually do what they want. They don't really necessarily listen to the members. So what structures are there in place to make sure that your leaders of PCS actually represent the views of the people who are paying their subs?
Well, we have an annual delegate conference with delegates from every branch in the union. We also have visitors to that event and trainee delegates and so on, so that people can participate. We have regional structures, and we have structures in the various groups like the DWP, Revenue and Customs, CLG, group conferences that deal with issues that relate specifically to the groups themselves. We have branches where members are encouraged to be involved in activities, and we try to get the highest possible turnout of our members in activities that the union is promoting.
Okay, and can you just give us an idea of the sorts of the main parts of the civil service that we have here in Bristol, and that you know, people might go past? You mentioned Department of Work and Pensions and various other things, and you said also the Coast Guards, and I know that that's one of the stories that we're going to be talking about in a minute. Mm-hmm. But what do we have as regards civil service here in the city?
Well, we have work and pensions, we have tax offices, and Revenue and Customs. I myself work at the Planning Inspectorate at Temple Quay, which is dealing with planning issues, refereeing decisions that are made by councils, and that's a big department in this city. There's also driving test instructors, and a lot of other a lot of other groups, which, there's also obviously the Ministry of Defence at Filton and in Bath. So, you know, there are a number of, you know, major areas of government work that are dealt with in Bristol, and where there are offices and where members of the public can come in contact with our members.
Now, I noticed one of the stories this week is that the Coast Guard service is being severely curtailed. Now, I don't know if you know anything about that, do you? Because I imagine that will be a lot of your members. I think this is one of the things, as Bristol was traditionally anyway a maritime city, and it looks now like many of the West's Coast Guard stations are simply going to be closed down.
Well, obviously, we're opposed to the closure of Coast Guard stations, because obviously it's another example of putting cuts and finance, putting the members of the public at risk. And, obviously our duty is to the public, and we want to ensure that the public get the best possible services and that they can live their lives in the most safe and hazard-free environment. So, yes, we oppose the cuts to those jobs and those services that are taking place across the country.
Well, it's all very well saying you oppose them, but how are you actually?
Well, we've taken strike action, and we've obviously been involved in major lobbying campaigns and so on. So we have and petitions and so on. So we have gone out to the public in order to explain exactly what our members do and the effects that those cuts will have on jobs and services.
Well, just quoting from today's Western Daily Press, three of the four Coast Guard stations that serve the West are to be axed. Despite a major government U-turn announced yesterday, Transport Secretary Philip Hammond reprieved a series of stations around the country, but Portland will still close despite a well-supported local campaign that's down on the South Coast. He will also shut Brixham in Devon and Swansea in South Wales, which between them cover many miles of West coastline, including beaches and cliffs along the South Coast and the Bristol Channel. Our updated proposals, he said, will ensure the safety of seafarers and coastal communities, delivering the modernised and more cost-effective service we need for the 21st century. As the Daily Press reported, ministers had intended to shut 11 of the 18 UK Coast Guard stations. Only two of those remaining would have been open at night after a lengthy consultation. Mr. Hammond has decided there will be just one 24-hour supercentre near Southampton on the South Coast. Now, ultimately, the government is in charge. We elected that government. So who are you to say that they shouldn't be shutting these Coast Guard stations?
Well, we represent our members, and we believe that, as I said earlier, that we have a duty to the public to ensure that they have the best possible services and the best possible safety. Our National Executive Committee has been meeting this week, and I'm sure that we'll be taking further action in order to defend those Coast Guard stations and to, you know, take the situation forward. We have a position as a union that we are opposed to cuts, and you know, we're campaigning hard to say to the government that there is an alternative to what they are proposing in terms of cuts across the civil and public services. You know, it is not for the public and for members of the public services delivering hard-pressed services to the people that that they serve to bear the brunt of a crisis which was actually caused by the banks and financial institutions.
Now, isn't there something a bit counterproductive about striking, though? It's almost like you're closing these stations for the government.
Well, I think the thing is that strike action is always a last resort. Obviously, the first option is to go and negotiate. But unfortunately, on occasions, as we've found over pensions, it's often very difficult to get this government to actually sit down and carry out a constructive discussion. So obviously, we, in those circumstances, we have no alternative but to take strike action and to seek to defend those services and defend the public and our members' terms and conditions.
Now, Jenny, you're Labour councillor for Southmead.
I'm sitting here actually thinking that this was in neither of the manifestos of either party that are now in power. They, in fact, the Liberal Democrats were supporting Labour in the way we economically felt we were going to solve the financial problem. So it's a complete U-turn by the Liberal Democrats, and the Conservatives obviously had thought about this somewhere in one of their back rooms and have suddenly brought it out of into the public arena. What I'm thinking about sitting here, you're saying Southampton, you're saying the south coast of Wales. We actually have shipping that's coming in from the Atlantic, which has some of the major storms, the major problems. How fast are they going to be able to get to rescue people from that distance away from where we had the Torrey Canyon? We've had all sorts of really bad shipwrecks, certainly on the Cornish and the Devon and coast, and it's notorious.
It does remind me a little bit, this story, of the whole thing about the fire control centres, because they were then, they're now talking about a sort of super Coast Guard place in Southampton where you're going to have a handful of people actually dealing with the entire coast of the west of England right the way round. In fact, possibly even the whole of the country. It's not entirely clear what they're saying here. But that means that all the local knowledge that's been built up by people who are actually manning these Coast Guard stations is going to be going to waste. Anyway, let's move on to our next story. And the BBC, a National Union of Journalists, are on strike today. And this is all over a dispute about compulsory redundancies. And I was down at the BBC White Ladies Road this morning, and I spoke there to Steve Brodie, who's Points West's crime correspondent, about why they were out on strike and why he was on the picket line.
My name is Steve Brodie. I'm the Home Affairs correspondent for BBC Points West. And the NUJ is on a properly balloted official strike today against compulsory redundancies being made by the BBC across the corporation, particularly starting today in the BBC World Service, one of the most respected, if not the most respected, broadcasting institutions in the world. We are striking because the BBC refuses to go to ACAS, which is very disappointing indeed, refuses to negotiate on these things. And the problem is there are people within the corporation who will take voluntary redundancy, people without young families, without mortgages, who are prepared to go. But the BBC won't accept those proposals, will compulsorily make people redundant who don't want to be made redundant. And that seems somewhat illogical. And because of the refusal to negotiate, refusal to go to ACAS, we're being forced reluctantly to strike for 24 hours in protection of the BBC, because once the BBC is gone, as we now realise, the alternative with Mr Murdoch is not one that I don't think many members of the public would want. But if the BBC is continually undermined, especially by the government, cutting the licence fee, which of course is not the fault of the BBC or its management, although it did accept a 24-hour negotiation to reduce the licence fee by 20%, for all those very good reasons, we're on strike today. I've been at BBC for well over 20 years, and my passion is news and to report for the BBC, and I'm proud that I work for the BBC, but we have sadly no alternative today.
Isn't it a bit naughty of you to conflate this with the Murdoch dispute? Because really, the BBC is just like any other public service now, having to make cuts. And why should the BBC be some sort of exception?
Well, it's not, it shouldn't be an exception at all. But I think I've pointed out quite extensively there that there are people who are willing to take redundancy, but they are being ignored, and people who don't want to take redundancy are being made redundant. That's illogical.
Surely, though, there's not enough people who are willing to do that. Isn't that what's happening here? The BBC is saying, well, there's not enough willing to take redundancy, so we're going to have to force one or two out.
At the moment, that's not the case at all. There are hundreds of people in the World Service who are prepared to go, and they are not being chosen.
And how does that affect people here at the BBC in Bristol?
Well, the BBC is one corporation. If it starts the World Service, the next time you look round, you won't have a regional broadcasting service, because we would have been made redundant. We are facing a situation where eventually the acts will come here, and therefore one wants to stop this particular arbitrary way of making people redundant now, not wait until it's too late.
Now, some people are saying that Rupert Murdoch put pressure on the LibCon coalition to keep the licence fee low. Is that the case? Do you know anything about that?
Well, I think what you mean is that the government, the coalition, caved into pressure from the Murdoch Empire as a payback for its support for the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats in the last general election. I don't know if that's true or not. That is a matter totally of subjective argument, isn't it? I would say that it does look as if the government did indeed pay back Murdoch for his support in the last election. There's no doubt about it for a fact that the Murdoch Empire did support the coalition.
That was Steve Brodie. He's the crime correspondent at BBC Points West outside White Ladies Road earlier today on the picket line at the BBC. Jenny, first you. Do you think that there's any... nobody actually at BBC Bristol is threatened with redundancy yet, so why are they striking?
Well, I should think they're worried, and many of them have got mortgages and families. What are they going to do if they lose their job? Can I say that I lived abroad, and I value the overseas service that we provide. It was really good to hear what was happening throughout the world. It was a really standalone service compared with many other broadcasting stations. And I also value the weather forecast, and so should all the people in this area, because then I know that I've got to take a Mac with me, an umbrella, that I've got to get out to protect my things that I grow in my garden from frost. And the things that the BBC provide are of a very high standard. I'm a Radio 4 listener, and I value that, and I know that lots of older people do, and they keep rubbishing us older people, but we have standards which are upheld by the BBC.
Roger Thomas, Roger Thomas from the PCS. What are your thoughts on this dispute, and particularly the comparison that Steve was making there, saying that, well, actually, Rupert Murdoch, it looks, put pressure possibly on the BBC to keep the licence fee low, and this is one of the reasons that they're having to make redundancies.
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is solidarity with the BBC journalists. I think it's excellent that they're taking strike action, because what they're doing is they're fighting to defend a public service which is under attack, and I obviously can relate to that, because as a public servant myself, my union is also under attack by from the government. But I think what we're seeing playing out is that it's the effects of the Whopping dispute 25 years ago, when Rupert Murdoch imposed a regime of non-trade unionism inside the Whopping factory of News International. And I think it's the fallout from that unethical journalism which was allowed to grow like a cancer across that particular industry. And I know that the NUJ have campaigned for many years for an ethical journalism which actually delivers news which can be trusted and is above reproach.
But why should we be paying through our taxes for the BBC when Rupert Murdoch and other private people can actually provide news without actually using our tax money? They're actually making a profit at delivering news.
But it's, can I come in? Because it's all about power. And some of these private entrepreneurs that are millionaires want power through this, the media that they control. And some of us would rather have the truth and facts so that we can think things through to our, by ourselves, rather than be brainwashed to think only things that other people want us to believe.
I think there's also an issue of accountability, and I think the thing is that the BBC and its journalism has always been accountable to the public and has responded to the public, and I think has presented the news on a fair and reasonable basis. Whereas what we're seeing with Rupert Murdoch's empire is that it's journalism which always has a slant in terms of the delivery of influence for the Murdoch empire, as opposed to the delivery of the truth and realistically clear, unbiased news.
If you can find it, you're doing well.
Yes.
Okay, so I didn't think it would take long to get from the BBC onto Rupert Murdoch and the phone hacking story. The revelations rumble on, so it's a good time to remember freelance journalist and author of Flat Earth News, Nick Davis, who's pursued the phone hacking story doggedly for The Guardian, certainly since 2008, 2009. Arguably, he understands better than anyone the background to it all, and here he is commenting on The Guardian website about Tuesday's nerve-wracking interrogation by the Home Affairs Select Committee of senior officers who were supposed to be in charge of the original phone hacking inquiry, the one that went nowhere, almost nowhere. Andy Heyman is one of them, but first we hear the testimony from John Yates. The commentary is from the Guardian freelance journalist Nick Davis.
I made it clear that had I known in July 2009 what I now know, I would have made different decisions, and I expressed quite clearly and publicly my regrets in terms of the impact on those potentially affected as a result. I would be very concerned if in doing this I'm judged to have been in any way disrespectful to this committee or any other committee.
The committee are pursuing the question of whether or not he has previously misled them, which means misleading Parliament. If you're found guilty of that, as they explained to him at the beginning, you can get hauled up in front of the House of Commons because you're in contempt of Parliament, which is a serious business. And at the end of about an hour of evidence, with John Yates doing his best to defend his position, the chairman of the committee, Keith Vaz, said, "Mr. Yates, it's the view of this committee that your evidence today has been unconvincing, and we may want you back again." I mean, that was a devastating conclusion.
Have you actually offered to resign?
No, I haven't offered to resign. And if you're suggesting that I should resign for what News of the World has done and my very small part in it, then I think that's probably unfair.
I think it's fair to say that that committee were clear that they can't understand why Yates is still in his job. And they pushed him hard on whether or not he's considered resigning or will resign. And he won't have any of it. And as I understand it, the Metropolitan Commissioner subsequently put out a statement standing by him. But it isn't obvious that he's going to be able to hold on. And there's this steady drip feed of evidence from the current inquiry, Operation Wheating. And every time they arrest somebody else, or we discover a new victim who they've warned, we see the extent of the failure of the original investigation overseen by Andy Heyman, and the subsequent period overseen by John Yates, and their position gets weaker and weaker.
Mr. Heyman, while a police officer, did you ever receive payment from any news organisation?
Good God, absolutely not. I can't believe you suggested that.
Lots of people do.
Well, come on, I'm not letting you get away with that. Absolutely no way.
I've never seen a committee do this before with a witness. They were openly laughing at him. And I think Heyman lost his way. He began to seem like a kind of stand-up cop. And it seemed to me that those two senior officers, John Yates and Andy Heyman, haven't locked in with the public mood about this since the Millie Dowler story that we ran last week. And therefore they were out of step with the politicians who were reflecting that public opinion. Suddenly the police witnesses are sitting there saying that News International were completely uncooperative, that they were hostile, obstructive, and that they told them lies. So, if that's true, why didn't you tell us that before? I mean, I'm prepared to accept that their evidence today is correct, but why didn't you tell us that before? Again, it smells of collusion.
Well, that's quite strong stuff there from Nick Davis at The Guardian on the Guardian website, talking about the Home Affairs Select Committee grilling of Andy Heyman and John Yates. Now, you first, Jenny Smith, what are your thoughts about the way that this story is going? Because it certainly looks as if there was a bit of nervousness amongst the police there being grilled by the committee, and also that it may not be the end of it, that they may well be asked back to the next Home Affairs Select Committee.
Right, I listened to Yates. I actually listened to that part of the questioning of him. I wasn't convinced. I thought it was nice patter. And, all right, if somebody else thinks it's collusion possibility, I think that it's what's coming out is that the police were frightened, politicians were frightened of the media, and it's about time we stop that, so that people can actually live by their conscience and what's right, and also the evidence that's before them, rather than evidence that suddenly comes out, which is warped to achieve what many of the right-wing press are pushing at us all the time. It's a form of brainwashing.
Okay, so before we hear from Roger on this, a second clip from the Guardian freelancer Nick Davis concerns threats and collusion, as Jenny was just alluding to there. Possible reasons the police failed to prosecute those allegedly ultimately responsible for the phone hacking.
Was there a factor there about fear of getting into a fight with News International? And I've spoken to senior officers who were around at the time who say that they believe there was. And then the other thing is that we keep picking up rumours that individual officers were frightened that skeletons in their own personal cupboard might be dragged out, and that out of that kind of very personal fear, they made a decision to cut short the inquiry because they didn't want the News of the World turning them over. Now, I don't know whether or not that's true, but it sits there as another unanswered question about why they didn't do the job properly.
Now, we've heard finally that Rebecca Wade, the boss of News International, has resigned today. But, Roger, what are your thoughts about this whole business here that Nick Davis is talking about there? He's saying basically that whether rightly or wrongly, some of the police felt that if they started to pursue this investigation, they would find personal skeletons in their closet appearing on the front page of The Sun and the News of the World.
Well, I think this goes to show the level of the influence peddling which has been taking place by News International. It shows the insidious nature of this type of news organisation, and the fact that its tentacles and its unscrupulous acts spread across the whole of the establishment. And I think, you know, there are a lot more skeletons to come out of the cupboard in the coming weeks. I don't think this is ended at all. I think Rebecca Brooks going is a step forward, but you know, I feel for the poor workers at the News of the World who've lost their jobs in an attempt by News International to hide their own shame and find scapegoats for their own culpability. I think it's good that both the Murdochs will be in front of the Parliament for questioning. But I think, you know, this has got to go much further. These people have been involved in quite unscrupulous acts, or have encouraged their journalists to be involved in quite unscrupulous acts. And I think, you know, that the public deserve the right that this should be dealt with, and this kind of influence peddling should be ended once and for all.
Well, we played a clip last week, a secret recording of Glenn Mulcair, who was the private investigator that was originally jailed for this back in 2006. And he was saying that there was actually, whilst he was being secretly recorded, there was a committee at the News of the World that was making these decisions. But that committee, it seems, hasn't actually been yet prosecuted. So maybe those are the people the Operation Wheating are actually interviewing at the moment. But Jenny, we've got someone new who's taken over from Rebecca Brooks. I said Rebecca Wade. She's actually, of course, now Rebecca Brooks. Tom Mockridge. And Mockridge apparently left journalism for a brief period to work as press advisor to Paul Keating, the former Australian Prime Minister, when he was treasurer in the 1980s. After 6 years working with Murdoch's Australian newspaper business, Mockridge was awarded a chief executive position at Foxtel, a pay TV joint venture. Since then, his position as one of Murdoch's key lieutenants has been confirmed by his handling of the family's interests at the wholly owned Sky Italia. Now, I have to say, I don't think of Italian television as being one of the sort of great examples that is going to take bring News International back into a sort of more acceptable, more ethical type of journalism.
No, it's just moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic as it goes down.
So what you really think that News International is going down?
I think parts of it will go down. As time goes by, we are going to find out a lot more about some of their dirty tricks that they were playing, some of the getting into people's personal lives, which it's immoral. They shouldn't. But can I say that we need to tighten up Ofcom? We need a code of guidance that's legally binding on the press, not so that it stops news where people are trying to cover up some of their bad behaviour or bad practices, but at the same time make sure that private lives of individuals are not hijacked like they have been.
But aren't you doing just what David Cameron's doing and trying to sort of spread the blame and say, oh, this isn't just Rupert Murdoch, everyone's at it?
Well, I've reported things to Ofcom in the past and got absolutely nowhere. It's a toothless tiger, and it's about time it actually did its job properly.
I think that's right. I mean, we do need a much more effective and robust system of press regulation to ensure that, you know, a similar scandal doesn't break out in the future. And I think one of the ways that we can do that is by the return of union organisation into the journalists and the newsrooms of all of these newspapers, so there is some kind of check at a news level on the basis of the kind of stories that are being run and the way that those stories are obtained. I think some of the stuff which is now coming out is absolutely abhorrent. I think most people are in shock and horror at the lengths to which Rupert Murdoch and his stable of papers has actually gone to in order to get news stories for their front pages.
But again, Roger, aren't you doing a similar thing to David Cameron in saying, well, we've got to regulate all the press more and more? Actually, this is criminal activity, and the police should have arrested people like Rebecca Raid and have actually interrogated them. Looks like they were afraid to.
I think that's right, and I think it shows the levels of corruption in our institutions. And I think this does go a long way. I mean, there are lots of influence with politicians and so on that have gone on over a number of years, with Rupert Murdoch selling the influence of the Sun and News of the World in order to get this or that political party elected. And obviously people are scared of the influence that this person has obtained. And I think, you know, it's necessary for us to, you know, have some control over monopolies. In, you know, there are supposed to be checks and balances on monopolies, but it doesn't actually seem to actually work effectively. And I think that's what we need to stop the monopolisation of the press.
Well, if you want my two halfpence, I think this whole story is going in the direction of Scotland Yard and possibly police officers arresting other police officers. We've got, although it sounds unlikely, you know, it may well happen, particularly for contempt of Parliament, which is one of the things that is being suggested for misleading Parliament. If Andy Heyman or John Yates have done that,
I think this can spread into a whole number of fields. I think it's not just police officers, Parliament. It could, you know, could be MPs. It could be a civil whole servants. Host of organisations. Could be civil servants.
Could be members of your union.
Well. Possibly of the First Division Association, but possibly, yes.
Okay, so, I mean, there is a book, actually, which came out in 2006 called Untouchables, Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard by Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn, two investigative journalists who are working very closely with The Guardian. Michael Gillard is very close to a lot of former detectives at Scotland Yard and, for example, does things like Guardian obituaries for them. And there was a bit of a scandal in 2006, quietly amongst the journalistic world, because The Guardian were talking about serialising some of the excerpts from this book, and yet The Guardian's lawyers said, oh, look, it's a little bit too dicey, you know, we're in debt, if we were to lose a big court case, The Guardian might go under, and so they didn't serialise it. But the Untouchables are actually listed in the book. These are people who have so much power and such good barristers that, even though there's evidence of corruption against them, the heads of the Metropolitan Police, the chief commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Paul Condon, said that, he believed that there were between 100 and 250 corrupt police officers. This is back in 1997 to the Home Affairs Select Committee, and yet he couldn't sack them because they had such power through the legal representation and barristers that they had. And correct or not, I'm not saying he's 100% right, that this book certainly lists John Yates and Andy Heyman amongst those list of untouchable officers at Scotland Yard. Anyway, to move on, ministers are urged to let schools and hospitals fail to hasten reforms. This is The Guardian on Monday. Polly Curtis, the Whitehall correspondent. Ministers have been privately advised to allow schools and hospitals to fail if the government is to succeed in its overhaul of public services, confidential government documents reveal. The Prime Minister will today announce long-awaited plans to end the state's monopoly over public services and give people more choice and control over what they use, in a white paper opening up swathes of the public sector to private companies, charities and mutuals. David Cameron will claim the welfare state is failing and promise to release the grip of state control and put power back into people's hands. But documents obtained by The Guardian under the Freedom of Information Act reveal research by civil servants warning that markets are susceptible to failure and costs could in fact rise unless a true market is created by allowing public services to collapse if they're unsuccessful. So this is pretty shocking to hear that stuff's been circulating up in London, actually urging ministers to let schools and hospitals fail to hasten reforms. Jenny?
Right. I daily get invited to training sessions all over the country now for contracting out services, whether it's the children's services, whether it's adult care, all services now. There are people standing at the sidelines waiting for local authorities, for health authorities, for everybody that has any public service to contract out. And at the moment, I mean, there are areas of the city health that are being looked at. We're having paperwork come to us about recommissioning of the mental health services in the city. We are having all sorts of other areas, youth clubs going contracted out. It looks like Connections might actually lose out completely on that. I've found that there's been cuts. Can I go on about cuts? Because I really am concerned that the general public only know little bits of it. And I would appeal to the general public to come forward and come to people like me to tell us, because they're finding out what's going on in their everyday life. I found that the breakfast clubs have been cut in my ward.
What are the breakfast clubs then?
Well, it's for children from families that they found were coming to school without any food inside them, that the children weren't learning so well in class, and they found that by providing a breakfast, before they started school, those children were achieving better in the schools. And we've got a lot of failing schools, or have had in the past, in this city. And it was one of the things that were used to turn these children round so that they started to get educated and feel that they could cope with a day at school.
But surely all this is about trying to create a market in these kinds of public services. The idea is that then you've got a whole bunch of different providers, each of whom is trying to outbid the other, and that people then, the public, get better value for money.
Not necessarily, because the youth service that is being contracted out has a £5 million cut in it. So whoever does run the youth service from now on will be struggling with a depleted funding and not being able to achieve the standards that I and the public would hope to want.
Well, yeah,
can
yes,
I say that there's cuts in probation? I've had the probation service cut. The building is now empty in my ward. Connections were invaluable. It was picking up children coming out of the secondary schools that weren't probably skilled reading and writing and arithmetic, giving them those skills. And what happened in my ward was some of those youngsters actually achieved qualifications and had gone on to training as youth workers. And guess who went first? Who's being pushed out first? It was those young people that for the first time in their lives they were achieving things, being valued, showing that they can contribute to the world that the rest of us live in, and they got their jobs taken away straight away. There's cuts in the police force going through. I think people have got to seriously think about the world our children and our children's children are going to have, because it's being ripped to pieces at the moment.
Now, Roger Thomas, Regional Vice Chair of the Public and Commercial Services Union, what's your thought about this story we just had there about ministers being urged to let schools and hospitals fail to hasten reforms? Because obviously this present government may not be in forever. They want to make sure, but by the time they finish, that they've got these reforms through and that they've put various of these types of public service out to the market.
Well, I think what it shows is that the government are not interested in the actual delivery of services. They're not actually interested in improving people's lives. They talk a good talk about people power and all the rest of it, but actually what this is a transfer of those services into the private sector. And I'm not sure, but I would imagine everybody listening to this programme would scratch their heads with great difficulty to think of a successful privatisation where the service that people received after privatisation was superior to the one before. It's not about fairness, it's not about balance. These are all just words that the governments are putting forward. And I think, you know, there's absolutely no way that the government can be trusted with the National Health Service, that they can be trusted with the welfare state. And I think, you know, show me a situation where a private company comes into a healthcare or education situation and that they're not interested in their balance sheet and in making a profit out of the delivery of that service. That means that it will be profit which dictates what is delivered, not what people need and the desperate need of many of the most underprivileged in our society, who are going to be the ones who are going to suffer the most.
But surely, I mean, the simple fact is, Roger, that there isn't enough money to go around, so they have to do this in order to cut back the spending.
Well, I think this is a mantra which the government has pushed forward. And basically, the government is using the figures of the deficit, to the public deficit, to raise the political attack of the destruction of the welfare state, the destruction of the settlement that we had after the conclusion of the Second World War, the idea of a land fit for heroes when they came back, that people wouldn't have to scrimp around and save before they could call a doctor to look after their children. They could get medical attention when and if they required it, that they could get a roof over their head. And this is becoming increasingly difficult because of the changes to housing benefit and also because of the huge cost of buying your own home. Most of my members cannot afford to even consider the idea of buying a home. Unless there are at least two of them in that transaction, so you know it's quite a change which is taking place, and we've been in a time and a place where the deficit was much higher after the Second World War, and in that period, in fact, I've got some figures here from 1918 to 61, the UK national debt was over 100% of gross domestic product. That's almost twice as high as it is today. And during that period, what did the government do? It introduced a welfare state, the National Health Service, state pensions, comprehensive education, built millions of council houses, and nationalised a range of industries, including rail. And I think all the hard-pressed rail users perhaps listening to this programme would understand how that organisation has suffered under private hands.
Well, it may be ex-rail users who are now sitting in their cars because they're fed up with the railways and they're overcrowding, particularly in the rush hour. Anyway, just to move on from that, Southern Cross landlords are now to take over all the Southern Cross homes. And this is quite a good example, really, of a transfer of public service into the marketplace, which has just really simply collapsed. Jenny Smith, you're someone that's been dealing with these kinds of services and part of your role in the City Council. What are your thoughts about what's happened with Southern Cross?
Well, I think it's appalling. We've got vulnerable people now not knowing whether in future they're going to stay in the home that they're in or whether they will actually be able to get somewhere safer to go to. And I'm also concerned about the City Council. We've issued a press release, and what we're saying is we're calling on the Liberal Democrat-controlled council to rethink the closure of elderly people's homes. And we do that because of the economic situation at the moment in this country, the fact that firms like Southern Cross clearly are only there to make money and not to provide a decent service that is safe for these people. Insolvency numbers are going up. They're higher than they have been for years. And just so that we address this mantra that it constantly being used, we actually, the national debt is going up, not down, because of the appalling lack of understanding of this government for economics and how to control finance. The more people you have in employment, the more people are paying income tax and national insurance, the more money is coming into the coffers, which we can pass on in order to slowly and steadily clear the debt.
Well, in the Independent this week, Oliver Wright was saying that the UK public debt is soaring to a record £2 trillion. Officials from the Office of Budget Responsibility will paint a grim picture of public finances over the coming years. Their report will conclude that there is now a widening gulf between what the government will need to spend in future compared with what it raises in tax.
I believe that this government is not fit to govern and has a very lack of understanding of running the economy of our country, which is going to eventually, it's going to be you and me that are going to suffer, the ordinary people of this country, not the hierarchy, who are well padded with a lot of wealth.
Well, they've got 3.5 years or so to try and sort it out, so we'll see in 3.5 years, I guess, unless there's a general election before that. And as if by magic, talking about the age-old problem of the cuts and ageing particularly, here's Marina Morris.
Hello. The age-old problem. The end of a person's life is important. There is an alternative to growing old, the young. As a society, our healthcare improves, we are living longer. Currently, about 18.5% of the UK's population is age over 65. The Office of National Statistics in 2009 recorded 11,600 centenarians in the UK. By 2050, estimates project, a quarter of million, more than 20 times. Good news for them, but the trends predict a looming crisis for the health service and treasury. As we age, we have a high rate of illnesses and disease. According to the Office for National Statistics, the average lifespan at birth of a male Bristolian is about 78 and a female 82 and is close to the UK national average. World Health Organization statistics show an average of 8% of life is developed economies are spent disabled. This would equate to about 6.5 years that average person suffers from debilitation at the end of their life. The question is, are problems inevitable and how can we reduce the negative impact of aging? It is obvious that some problems of old age are echoes of lifelong unhealthy choices, poor ambitions or short-term thinking. The noble targets of being active in old age is diminished by allowing drugs, alcohol or obesity to control us. We all have habits which we could improve and transform the average of 6.5 years of suffering to years of enjoyment in the end of life. We have to choose to be different. We need to change the brain. Our own free will plays a significant role in achieving good health in old age. According to Alcohol Concern, there are 1.6 million dependent drinkers in the UK. In contrast, the average life expectancy of Russian males is 59, about 19 years less than average Bristolian. Experts point out that Russian health crisis is a result of high rate of alcohol abuse and smoking. Everybody knows it, but nothing changed. Some longevity health scientists believe that main problem of old age has shifted from physical health to emotional and mental health. Dementia now is more common than cancer and cardiovascular disease, the main cause of mortality later in life. You don't die of dementia. You die with dementia. Is this why the funding for dementia research is negligible at £61 per patient compared to £295 per cancer patient? According to Alzheimer's Research Trust Dementia Report 2010, for every dementia patient in the UK, the cost to its economy is over £27,600 per year. This is more than 4.5 times the cost for each cancer patient. As young adults, the most common cause of death is accident, which from our mid-40s switch to heart attack and cancer. The usual advice to reduce the risk of disease of old age is to eat well, get plenty of exercise, stop smoking, and not consume excessive alcohol levels. But there is another approach to stay healthy, a positive attitude and thinking young. We all individuals, and age is a statistic, not a club. We often view the elderly as a dependent resources users, but often the elderly actually generate resources. They give their time to charities or care for the grandchildren, whilst parents are at work or help society in so many other ways. Many vulnerable dementia patients are cared for 24/7 in specialist homes such as formerly run by company Southern Cross. This company is now in the trouble because council across the country responding to the spending cuts have tightened eligibility criteria for funding. As a result, as some patients died, they were not being replaced at the same rate. Occupancy and income fell and company found it was unable to pay the rent on its buildings. This week, the company allowed control of its properties to revert back to its landlords, many of whom are offshore companies based on his tax havens. The Emir of Qatar, who has been traced as a significant investor in one of these companies, said that as an investor, he is unable to control the levels of rent and that the money from the rents is paid to major banks. Lloyds and Royal Bank of Scotland, both part owned by the government, have a large exposure to these loans.
Okay, Marina, thanks very much. Now, Jenny, just quickly before the news, can you just give us your response to that? Because it seems like there's a combination here, really, of austerity measures, plus also people are living too long.
Well, yes, but we need a decent living too long, don't we? We need enough money to be able to survive. And that's what's been taken away from the next generations of workers in our country.
Now, Roger, you're from PCS. What do you think about all this? Is it, you know, fair to actually be almost pointing the finger of blame at people saying, you're living too long?
Well, I think people should be able to live a decent life while they're working, and should have the opportunity when they retire to live comfortably and to see out the last of their days in comfort, and hopefully that will take as long as possible. And that's why we support the idea of education, which is lifelong education, because it's often, as was said, that it's, you know, it's the issues of mental health which are a factor in the terms of how long people live. And I think one of the issues is that people feel useful, and that people are actually challenging themselves intellectually to bring out the fullness of their actual potential. And I think, you know, this is an ongoing process through somebody's entire life. And I think, you know, people should have the opportunity to take any opportunities for education, but for leisure activities, sport activities, well into their 80s or 90s. I hope to live as long as I possibly can, and to enjoy a healthy and fruitful life.
Okay, Roger, you're Regional Vice Chair of PCS. Thanks very much for joining us, and you'll be staying till after the news. And also, thanks very much to Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. After the news, we'll be talking more to Roger, but also Princess Diana, that band film, the final episode.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.